The Lord speaks to us in a way that governs the whole nature and character of our lives. And so regardless of the circumstances in which we find ourselves, there's always direction that God has given us and a behavior that He has defined and a character that we need to try to maintain in our own lives. And it is interesting to study different relationships and different circumstances in life, and we tend to do that in our studies, and we'll do that tonight as we talk about the Christian in the workplace, the Christian at work in this world. But whether you're talking about that or parenting or marriage or the Christian's relationship to civil government and all of these different kinds of things are fundamentally governed by the character that's defined in God's Word. And that has more to say about the behavior in those various relationships than the specific passages that address that relationship. In fact, when you start to try to do a study on the marriage relationship in the Bible, there's not that many different passages to read. There's a few. And of course, the family and raising children and treatment of husbands and wives as they relate one to another is such a huge part of our life, we almost wonder why the Lord didn't tell us more about it. We struggle with it. We wonder what we ought to do and how to solve our problems and settle our complicated situations. And yet, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, or the teaching about the character of God's disciples in Ephesians chapters 4, 5, and 6, generally speaking, as it talks about everything that we ought to be, that's what makes us good husbands, wives. That's what makes us what we ought to be in every relationship of life. But there is value in looking at passages that specifically address particular situations. And as I try to figure out why God said so little on the one hand, well, because His general instructions apply in all these situations. You don't have to deal a different set of rules for every circumstance, because integrity and purity and spirituality governs all those relationships. Well, then when we do look at what God says and what He does specify, why are those things mentioned? And probably because, and that probably is important, because God didn't tell us why He said what He did about the relationships. But I'm guessing that probably He addresses them specifically because these are areas where we have difficulty doing what we know we ought to do, or else there was a problem either in temptation or in the circumstance in which the apostles were addressing that called for admonitions. And so these specific instructions will generally address areas of weakness. But fundamentally, if we are faithful children of God, that is what will determine how we behave in all of our relationships. You know, the rule of kindness and a soft answer, that works in the workplace, and it sure works at home, doesn't it? And those are the fundamental rules of spirituality help us to know what we ought to do. But as we talk tonight about the Christian in the workplace, what I thought we'd do, and I wondered how to cover a lot of different things quickly, decided not to go with the chart, but just to go through a list of Bible characters tonight. And we'll see how many we get through. I think I've got 13 to look at, and I see the chuckles. But I'll quit when time's up, even if I don't finish them all. But just kind of work through some Bible characters that give us a picture of the disciple of Christ or the child of God in the workplace. And there'll be Old Testament and New Testament characters. First person I think about is Adam. And you know, we read about Adam in the book of Genesis, we realize that already God has something to say about man and his place on this earth, and that we've got a responsibility to work. Adam was put in the garden, and it was obviously a place that was created by God to be a place for his comfort and his well-being. And though God made it a perfect kind of a paradise, a relationship with God, but also a paradise in the sense of his relationship with the creation in which God put him, Adam still had work to do. God told him, I want you to dress and keep the garden. Now, this was before the problem of weeds and thorns and thistles and the whole idea of working by the sweat of one's brow. Man, before sin was even in the picture, he is, not just was, but he is a creature that is designed and created for work, for responsibility. And so we need to look at work that way. Work is not just the way we pay the bills. It's not just the way we satisfy our own needs with rent and groceries. Work is a part of our makeup and our nature as creatures of God. And we were created to live lives of responsibility and production. And Adam illustrates that in the Garden of Eden. He was told in 2:15 of Genesis to dress and keep the garden. Adam and Eve were to bear children and fill the earth and exercise dominion over all the earth. There's a sense of responsibility that belonged to Adam and Eve even before sin. The work and the responsibility to work intensified after sin as the curses were placed on the earth and he would work and make bread by the sweat of his brow. And so that curse intensified that. But even without and even before that, let's understand that we are creatures for work. And so when we think about retirement, are we coming to some point in life where we no longer have any responsibility, where we don't have to be productive anymore? I think it's inappropriate for a Christian to think in those terms. Now, we might want to quit the driven job that we struggle with and wear down by over the years. But in retirement, let's take on responsibility and new work, things that we can do so we can continue to be that responsible, productive creature that God designed men and women to be. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 12, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the fullness of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. The point there is that we feel better and we do better when we're working. And we need to instill that in our children. And we need to remember that all through our lives while we have our complaints about how hard we have to work and how unfair it is on the job where we are laboring and how we look forward to a retirement. But let's understand that before God, we've got things to do, and that'll be good for us and a glory to Him. The second person I want to think about is the Apostle Paul. We're jumping from Adam to the Apostle Paul. We're obviously not going in chronological order here. But in the Apostle Paul, we see that not only do we work because we are commanded, created for good work, and in 2 Thessalonians 3, verses 10 through 12, we're commanded to work. There we read, for Paul says, even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. For we hear that there are some who walk among you in a disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies. Now those who are such, we command and exhort through the Lord Jesus Christ that they work in quietness and eat their own bread. There's a specific command. The child of God has a responsibility to work, first of all and foremost, to provide for himself. There's the responsibility. Other passages like 1 Timothy chapter 5 talks about caring for those of our own household. We've got a responsibility. That's our job. Not our job here as a part of the workforce. That's our job, or rather should I say our duty as children of God, to work and to provide for ourselves. But even beyond that, in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28, we've got the responsibility to work with our hands the thing that is good so that we may have to give to him that has need. One of the reasons we're supposed to work is so that we can give to others. In 1 Timothy, Paul told him to be ready and to be willing in work. And so, finally, in 1 Corinthians 16 and 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, those passages that we read about the collection for the needy saints and giving, if we sow sparingly, we will reap sparingly, but if we give liberally or generously, that's the way we will reap. We need to remember that we've got a responsibility to work, to take care of ourselves, to take care of people who need our help in addition to our own family, and also to contribute to the work and be an asset, financially even, to the work of the Lord and His people and His cause. And that's the way the Apostle Paul lived. Even as a gospel preacher, an apostle of Jesus Christ, he talks about, on a variety of occasions, how that when he was in this city or that city, in particular in Corinth, he said, I worked, I labored with my hands, toiling night and day, so that I would not be a burden to anyone. And he talks about that, not in the sense of pride, but as laying on them a realization, this is the way it's supposed to be. We are workers, and we need to take responsibility for ourselves. And certainly, those are some reasons to work. And so, let's get to work. We need to be productive in a financial way. But Solomon teaches us something about that responsibility to work. And Solomon was certainly a productive individual. He had the blessing of God with him. But in the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon, he calls himself the preacher, And he's the son of David, the third king of Israel. And his reign was the most prosperous. It was the most peaceful. And in some respects, it was the best time. It was the height of the glory of the nation of Israel. It was during Solomon's reign that spiritually they started to take a downturn. But as the world would look at the nation under Solomon's leadership, Israel was at its height. And he was very ambitious. In fact, his work and building programs in Israel were amazing. And of course, the temple that he built, the temple of God, built by Solomon, was the most significant structure at all, but a lot of other works. And he built outposts and fortresses in outlying areas along trade routes well beyond the borders of Israel, establishing commerce that was worldwide. And Solomon then was a man of achievement. But what's interesting is we read in the book of Ecclesiastes, we get some insight about the idea of working and being productive and being successful. Now, God commands us to work. It's our nature to work. We need to work more than just enough to eat, but to have extra to provide for others. And so we might be moving in this direction of the more we make, the more we can accomplish, the better it is. But we need to be careful about carrying that too far. In Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 3, what profit has a man from all of his labor in which he toils under the sun? He raises the question, and he's going to answer it. What's the profit for a man who lives under the sun or on this earth, a man living on this earth? What does he get from all of his labors and all of his investment of time and energy? What's the return? Well, let's go to chapter 2, begin reading in verse 4. He talks about himself and he says, I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all those who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and other special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward for all my labor. Did you hear that? My heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward from all my labor. Verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor which I had toiled. And indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. We need to understand that responsibility to work and to even prosper, to be in a position to help others, to have an excess so we can use it. There's an advantage in that. But I think also the spiritual principle here is that we've got to be careful that we do not invest our love and our life in our work. And this is a trait of American culture that, again, that we've got to be careful about. It's not a spiritual attitude. But to build a financial empire or to build a company that we're going to pass on to generations, to be like some entrepreneur that we have set up as an icon and to walk in his steps. Solomon is telling us, you do that and you succeed beyond even your current imagination. And one day you're going to look back on it and say, it's all emptiness. It's a waste. Waste in the sense that it does not satisfy the human spirit and your own soul. It will not provide you the satisfaction of the needs of your own heart. Because ultimately, what the human character is about is relationships. First and foremost with God, so that we can live at peace with ourselves and in confidence about the future. And secondly, with people who care about us because they know us. And they don't have any concern about the empire that we've created. You think about it. When everything's said and done and I have built my empire, what I really want is somebody that will sit in my home, however big or small it is, and look at me with eyes that care. That's what we want. And to know that God cares, that's what we want. And Solomon here understood finally, after he built the empire, that this is all kind of empty. It's just stuff. And okay, I've built this building and I've been that. He's the Donald Trump of way back when, right? And all the things I've done, what's next? Well, I just got to build another one because this one isn't satisfactory. It doesn't do it. And the point is, it's vanity, and we keep pursuing that dream because it is not satisfying. However, we keep reading, and he brings balance into the picture. The point is not them not to have any ambition. The point is not that you shouldn't try and that you shouldn't invest yourself seriously, because in chapter 3, beginning in verse 9, we read, "What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied." Now, hear the different tone here and the language used to describe the work. What about this labor? "I've seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to the end. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God." Do you hear the balance? Here's the person that is God-centered. It's godly. The focus of his life is God and righteousness. That governs everything he does. And so when it comes to his labor, his career, his dream ambition for his job, what he does is he applies himself to it. But he does that with a view of eternity in mind. He does that with a realization that God makes all things beautiful. And I don't understand the beginning and the end of God, but I know my focus and my trust on God. And Solomon says, that's the best way. That's the way it needs to be. Nothing is better for that person than to rejoice and to enjoy the good of his labor. You can do that when it's in the right perspective. That this is not what my life is about. God is what my life is about. And so what's our view about our career? And young people here, as you think about, what do you want to be when you grow up? What kind of job do you want to have? What is your dream career? Understand that you need to be ambitious enough that you've got a goal. You may need to change your mind at some point, but you're working towards something. Get an education. Apply yourself with some skills. Invest your time and your energy, but keep it in perspective. That job is not heaven. And that career, if you do reach that ultimate goal in your career, it will not satisfy. It will not give you what you really want. Keep the Lord in the center of things. And then work. And allow that be a supplement to who you are. In this country, our career defines us. And we're told that we need to find a career that will make us happy. It does not exist. Career won't make us happy. And you're just never done. But an ambitious work that is governed by God, focused life. That's what Solomon says can allow us to rejoice in the good fruit of our labor. Without God and His way, the labor and the fruit of our labor is the striving after wind. Bring that balance into it. You read Ecclesiastes and it'll help in that regard. And read it frequently as you go forward in your life. But then there's another character. I don't know his name, maybe because it's a parable. But the man who built bigger barns. Remember him? In the parable of Jesus, there's a question asked, you need to tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. And Jesus says, I'm not a judge of these matters. I'm not your judge in these kinds of things. But Jesus saw in this man's question, you know, of everything that Jesus came to do, this is what you're asking me? You're in my presence and you're wanting your fair half of the inheritance? And Jesus wants to pull him back to what's important. And so he tells him the story about the man who built bigger barns. We need to avoid materialism and worldliness as we go about our work and our business, as we think about our life and our career. That if we work hard and the Lord blesses us, we will have the opportunity to succeed. And we will have the opportunity to store up things beyond our basic necessities. Very possibly, if things are right, maybe even likely in good times. That may be a reality for us, but we've got to be careful. The man who tore down his barns and built bigger barns was not condemned because he was that prosperous, but because he had no regard for God in the work and in his planning. He said to his own soul, "Eat, drink, and be merry. You've got everything you need." And he was not rich toward God, was the statement of Jesus Christ. We've got to understand we don't have anything if we do not have a relationship with the Lord. And our focus on the material and the worldly will cause us to lose our soul. Paul wrote to Timothy that godliness with contentment is great gain. We work hard, and we may be ambitious to succeed, but we must be content with whatever comes. And certainly we need to maintain our focus on the Lord. In Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 34, we mentioned this morning in that Sermon on the Mount where Jesus was talking about lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust and thieves will take away from you the things that you possess. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And I thought that's odd wording. I thought that where your heart is, that's where your treasure will be, right? But Jesus said it the other way around. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be. And the question is, what is your treasure? What do you treasure? Because whatever it is you treasure, that's where your heart, that's where your allegiance will be. And if your treasure is worldly, if my treasure is money and a bank account or a business, material things, if that's my treasure, if that's what I value, if that's what I invest myself and my life for, then that's where my heart is. And if our heart is in this world, we will never see the heavenly. He says, lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth. The next section in that Matthew 26, again, is where he says, talks about the eye being single, and no man can serve two masters. And in this part of his conversation about materialism, it suggests the idea, you know, not everybody has got their heart set on material things. There's a lot of people, those that Jesus was talking to, they wanted to serve God, and they wanted to hold on to the material as well. It's like they've got their hands grasping both goals, both ends of the spectrum. And Jesus is saying there, you cannot serve two masters. You'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll love the one and hate the other. You're going to choose. You do choose. We do choose. The problem here is that we're like the man that asked Jesus, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus told him, "Sell all you have." And he walked away sorrowfully. He wanted to be with Jesus. He wanted to go to heaven. But he wanted to hold on to his things. We can't serve two masters because you'll choose. We choose. And what's dangerous about it is that, like that rich man, we choose wrongly. And so see that and recognize that. Because this one's just too close and too obvious, and therefore so much easier to let loose of the Lord because he's later and he's somewhere else. We don't see him as close. So don't try to serve both. And then he notches it up again to a higher standard when he says, don't be anxious. Because then what is he talking about in terms of material things? What you shall eat, what you shall drink, and your clothes, what you shall wear. The clothing there is not talking about styles and fashion. It's talking about keeping yourself warm in the wintertime, and shaded from the sun by your clothing. He's talking about the basic necessities of life. You see, don't put your treasures on earth, but in heaven. Don't try to serve both. And then he takes it one more step and quit worrying about your daily necessities. The Lord will provide if you seek first the kingdom. The man who built bigger barns had no thought for God. He failed the first. His treasure was on earth, and that's all he got. Then there's Onesimus. You know who Onesimus is? You read about him in the letter to Philemon. And the point in the story of Onesimus is that he illustrates that it may be easy to be a good servant for a good master, even though not everybody is. A lot of people have good masters and they're still bad servants. But it's easier to be a good servant for a good master. But it's tough to be a good servant for a bad master. And Onesimus is the slave that ran away from his master and was later converted by the Apostle Paul. But in Ephesians chapter 5, or excuse me, Ephesians chapter 6, should read here. It's just such a clear statement of a responsibility that we have on the job. Verses 5 through 8, bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, with sincerity of heart as to Christ, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will doing service as to the Lord and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he is a slave or free. You see, the principles apply to the free servant, the employee, or the bondservant, the slave. The attitude in service is the same. We will be judged by the same standard regardless of the nature of our service. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, let as many bondservants as are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and His doctrine may not be blasphemed. And those who have believing masters, let them not despise them because they're brethren, but rather serve them, because those who are benefited are believers and beloved. Teach and exhort these things. You know, we're tempted not to offer the best service when the master doesn't deserve it because he's lousy, he's unfair, he's mean and harsh and demanding of things that aren't possible to supply. We hate to serve that master. And the temptation is to slack off and not serve well. But here's an indication that it may be a temptation to slack off when the master is a brother in Christ. Because after all, he's going to give me a break. You know, we're brothers. He's going to give me a break. He owes me because we're brothers. And our relationship is not the same. And Paul commands that you need to especially serve your brother. Be the best servant you can possibly be. And other passages talk about those who serve a harsh and a froward or a master that abuses his servants. That you need to serve because that's what Christ did. Suffered unjustly, but was glorified by God. Onesimus ran away, and we don't know why. The letter doesn't say. But he comes to the Apostle Paul as he converted to Christ. And so what does Paul tell him he's got to do? He writes a letter to Philemon and says, receive this servant. And whatever he owes you, if he can't pay, I will pay. And Onesimus has got to take that letter back to the master that he defrauded, evidently robbed him when he ran away. And what a task. Philemon, if he does what the letter to, or excuse me, Onesimus, if he does what Paul said he was to do in the letter to Philemon, was a slave that changed his heart and his attitude and became what he ought to be under the gospel of Christ. The gospel changes us. It changes the way we look at our work and our relationship with our masters in this world, whether we are working as free men or as bond servants. But then there's the other side of that picture, and that's the master, Philemon. And Philemon was to receive him back and to treat him like a brother. From a business standpoint, he did not owe him treatment like a brother, because he should have been beaten or worse. He should have been held accountable, because you let slaves misbehave, and what's going to happen to the rest of them? You know, anarchy. That's the business view in that day and in that relationship. Paul says in Christ there's a different standard. You're going to receive him back as a brother, and now as somebody who's profitable to you. Now Philemon was going to raise some questions by his conduct if he did what the Apostle Paul told him to do. You know, some of the other slaves might maybe scratching your head. What's the deal here? It's a little bit like the prodigal son. Why are you killing the fatted calf for him? He cheated on you and he ran away. We've been here all along. What about us? But it's interesting how the gospel is calling for people to change. And certainly it calls for masters to do better by those who are in their care. If they're children of God, they will lead and they will command and they will rule in a proper way. Deuteronomy says, do not oppress the hired servant, no matter who he is, an Israelite or a foreigner. You treat him fairly. You pay wages in a timely manner. In the book of Deuteronomy, God's people were commanded that they would pay the wage at the end of the day because they probably need it to buy food that evening. The point is, you do not hold the wage overnight. Now, I'm not so sure that that system is going to work in our society, in our culture. But the principle of you make sure that the people that are working for you have what they need on a day-to-day basis. Nobody needs to go to bed hungry is the point. That's what masters were to do. They were to listen to the complaints of servants in the book of Job 31. Don't cheat in any business dealings, and you pay what's due in Jeremiah 22. You pay a worthy wage in 1 Timothy 5:18. Do not threaten, Ephesians chapter 6, verse 9. Don't threaten. Give what's just and equal, Colossians chapter 4, verse 1. What's interesting, we read in Ephesians chapter 6 about the service and the submission of the slave or the bondservant to the master. We read that and how that you need to serve him as though you're serving Christ with all your heart, not with eye service, but you do be a faithful servant whether he's watching you or not. And then Ephesians chapter 6 verse 9 says to the masters, do the same things. How can the master do the same things as what he just told the servant? Because, I mean, obviously, that's flip-flop, right? And the point is that do you understand the state of mind and heart that is commanded of the servant here? He cares about you and your business, and he's going to treat you right and fair and give you what is proper because he loves the Lord, and he's going to be a person of integrity. That's the way he serves you. And that's exactly the way you're going to be a master to him. You're going to be fair. You're going to be concerned about his interests. You're going to care about him as though you were caring about the Lord. That's why he says to the masters, you do the same things. Doesn't seem to make sense on the surface, but consider the relationship. Obviously, there's a role here that's established. The servant or the subordinate and the superintendent or the master, that's a role that's established. But if they care about each other, what a work relationship that brings to this environment. Now, is that what it's like where you work? Maybe, and maybe not. But the point is that as a child of God, we will do our part no matter what. We will serve the master faithfully regardless. So how did Philemon treat Onesimus when he got back? Well, if he was the kind of Christian that he ought to have been, he welcomed him as a brother. And they would settle it in a way that would satisfy righteousness and kindness and forgiveness. And Onesimus would work and Philemon would treat him with respect. And who knows what would have happened over time. But that's what happens when the Lord's will is being done. What kind of work can a Christian do? What about Zacchaeus? Zacchaeus was a tax collector. Remember the wee little man? Climbed up in the sycamore tree the day before to see. He was a tax collector, and the Lord went home with him. And Zacchaeus turned from sin and said, whatever I have extorted unlawfully, I will restore fourfold. I don't know if Zacchaeus continued to be a tax collector or not. But obviously, if he was going to serve the Lord and he's going to be a tax collector, he would have to change the way he did business. He had to be fair and right. And he could not be what was typically understood to be tax collectors in the first century. Remember the phrases? He eats with publicans and sinners. He eats with tax collectors and sinners. The wording tax collector was the equivalent of wicked person. That's what they were looked like in society. And the point I want us to notice by that, there are professions. There are environments that are not compatible with Christianity. That if you're going to be a faithful Christian in that environment and in that work situation, you're going to have to struggle and fight to carve out a new way of life in an environment that is not conducive to Christianity. That's Zacchaeus as a tax collector. How's he going to meet his quota with the Roman government, knocking on people's door and speaking nicely like Jesus Christ would, turning the other cheek? And somebody asks for his coat or his tunic, he gives him his cloak also. How successful as a tax collector is he going to be? Nobody wants to pay their taxes. So did he really stay a tax collector? Maybe. Maybe. But you see the struggle. And we need to understand that there are careers and there are works that are not really that compatible with Christianity. And we're going to have to struggle to be a Christian. But we can't make excuses. If that's where we are and if that's where we're going to be, we still got to do what's right regardless. Because there are some things that we cannot do on the job, whether it's our own business or whether we're working for somebody else. We cannot compromise morality and do or say or think that which is immoral and wrong. We just can't do it. We can't lie. We can't steal. We cannot cheat. We cannot do things that involve ourselves in sin. We cannot produce or promote or sell sin or the products that are a part of sin. We can't do that. It's just not lawful to have that kind of fellowship and that kind of association with ungodliness. And that eliminates some careers. And it also eliminates jobs. We can't be in a place and we cannot choose as a lifestyle things that are going to damage our influence and place ourselves in a dangerous, spiritually, a dangerous environment. So I don't know what Zacchaeus did about his job. But the first thing he had to do was restore fourfold everything that he took unlawfully or inappropriately. And it makes me wonder how long he would have been a successful tax collector. And so we need to be careful about the choices we make. We need to choose work and a lifestyle that provides an outlet for honesty and integrity and goodness. And we need to avoid work that's going to threaten our spirituality. We got way too many young people moving to New York City and doing in their schooling and in their work what they shouldn't be doing. And working with people they shouldn't be working with. And working in an environment they shouldn't be working with. Taking a job to write copy, you know, the stuff that's read, whether it's advertising or news flashes or whatever, for MTV. That young man, he does not need to be in New York working for MTV. I mean, that's an environment that's going to destroy spirituality. All he's doing is writing copy. Yeah, but that's not a company that you need to be with, right? You don't go to New York to be a faithful Christian while you study dance and theater. You know how many young people do that? Coming from Christian homes throughout the United States is discouraging to me. They're all excited about a church. There's a good church in New York City, and I'm going to be able to worship God while I study dance. And we don't see them. They don't worship with us. While they're doing their planning, I'm coming. Tell me where you are, how I can meet you and worship with you. Very, very few. In the financial industry, you go down the list. There are environments and there are jobs that will destroy spirituality. Even some that of themselves are not necessarily evil. You know, if you're going to work in the financial business, whatever it is, a banker, a loan officer, or a stockbroker, or whatever, you're going to be in an environment that's doing legitimate, honest business. The government at least tries to keep everybody honest in that environment and monitor it pretty close. So from what I gather from the young men that are working in that industry that I know, there's not a whole lot of cheating going on. We hear about the cheating because it makes the big news, the headlines. But there's not much cheating because it can't. The regulations are tight. But it still destroys spirituality because they're working 80 to 90 hours a week. Literally, I'm not exaggerating, 80 to 90 hours a week. It's not a whole lot of time for the Lord. They need to go back to Kentucky or wherever they came from so they can serve the Lord with the work that they're going to do. We need to make choices that will not threaten us spiritually. What about the use of time and the setting of priorities? Kind of meshes what we just talked about. Zacchaeus had to be careful about the nature of his work and how he was going to function in an environment that may not be conducive to Christianity. But in the matter of choices that we make, maybe I'm fudging a little bit here, but Lot pitched his tents towards Sodom. And it was a career choice, wasn't it? They were shepherds. Abram said, "We're going to have to split up, Lot. There's not enough grass for all our sheep. The wells are running dry and the shepherds are fussing. So, Lot, choose where you want to go." And the way the Scripture talks about Lot pitching his tents towards Sodom and then identifying them as evil cities, it's a very strong suggestion that that was known. And Lot went there anyway. And he wasn't in the cities at first, but by the time you get to Genesis about, 15 or so, Lot is living in the city now. He's made good. He's got him a house in the city. I don't know exactly how it all happened, but he's living in the city. And from what we gather in the New Testament description of Lot, how that his righteous soul was vexed by that evil city, that Lot maintained his own personal level of spirituality and faithfulness to the Lord in spite of everything. And you know you can do it. In bad environment, you can do what's right. But if we keep Lot as an example, we might add, and you'll probably lose your family. Lot lost his family. In our career, and in our financial and material choices, we've got to choose from a spiritual basis and make sure that we're not putting ourselves and our families at risk. Also an important part of work as it pertains to the gospel. I'm going to finish with Esther. She didn't exactly choose to be queen and try out. She was chosen to be queen. But now she's the first lady. That was a job that she didn't ask for, but she's certainly got a prestigious role. And yet we see her in the peculiar position of saving God's people, and I believe by God's blessing, securing God's eternal plan. You know, the law in Persia that was signed that called for the extermination of all of the Jews was something that very easily and likely would have been accomplished, because they did not have the power to resist and to defend themselves on this nationwide empire scale. And that's why Esther made her appeal to the king that he would do something, because Haman had tricked the king and was acting in his own selfish, resentful, from his own resentful state of mind. And Mordecai tells her, "Who knows if you are not put in this position for just this purpose?" We don't know why we are where we are sometimes, because we cannot see the big picture. We make our choices along the way, and we need to do that carefully and with spiritual values. But then there are things that happen over which we have no control. We wonder, how did I get here? But wherever we are, remember that we can count for good and we can accomplish good in God's plan. Not all of us will do something as significant as Esther, certainly. But there's a lot of characters along the trail of the story of the Messiah from Genesis to Revelation of people who stepped up to do what needed to be done. On the job, in their communities, in the relationships where they lived, they just stood for what was right. Remember Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, taken into captivity. They didn't volunteer for that job either. But that's where they were, and that's where they had a responsibility to work as faithful servants under an idolatrous pagan society. And they counted for good. And that's what you can do wherever you are. So I hope that some of these stories and characters and principles are useful to you. It's a big subject, isn't it? But it's mostly about just being a faithful child of God in every respect, all of the time. Young people, think now about where your career and your job and your education choices will take you. Geographically even, but more than geographically, where they'll take you culturally and materially. And be careful that you don't choose a dream job that turns into a nightmare for you spiritually. It's hard to back up and undo sometimes. So choose wisely in that regard. If you're not a child of God, you have the opportunity to come to the Lord tonight. And if as a Christian you've not been what you ought to be, fix it. The Lord will do the hard part. He offers you the blood of Christ that can remit sins, and He offers you the opportunity to turn back to Him, and He will forgive. That's the hard part. That's the big part of the equation. What we need to do is bow in confession and submission and turn to Him in prayer and ask for that forgiveness. If we can help in any way, come to the front as we stand together and sing.